Blog Talk Radio.
Paranexus Universe. Today is Thursday, May 6, 2010. This is Doug Kelly, your host here with Grant Rubendunst.
Hey, everybody, welcome. Going to be a great show tonight.
Yes, it is. This is show number 112. I even checked it out.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So we're on a roll. And we welcome all of those who are listening live and those who will listen to the archive. Glad you could join us. Those in the chat room as well. And if you'd like to join us in the chat room, please do. If you have questions, you can type them in there. If you have a question that you'd like to call in and ask, you can certainly do that. The numbers are on your screen, 347-945-7799. And you can also use that Skype click-to-talk button if you've got a headset on your computer. So
yeah, call in. You know, we won't bite.
Not
if we have any visiting vampires, you know, this week, we'll tell them to stay away.
Yeah, no visiting vampires.
No bite. No biting.
No goblets of blood.
Absolutely.
All right,
not.
You had to have been here last week to understand that joke. Okay, so tonight we are pleased and honored to have David Roundtree with us. David is a director of the Scientific Paranormal Investigative Research Information and Technology Group, a paranormal research laboratory dedicated to the design, build of detection, and data recording of environmental aspects of paranormal phenomena. And he's co-director of the New Jersey Paranormal Research Group, an investigative organization which performs investigations and field experimentation. David has been involved in the paranormal research field since 1976. He is a professional member of the Rhine Research Center, the Audio Engineering Society, the International Frequency Sensor Association, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. David's background as an audio and acoustic engineer, police officer, and current studies in physics and quantum mechanics makes him a vital contributor to the Spirit and New Jersey Paranormal Research Group mix. David designs and builds much of the specialized equipment used on investigations with input from other team members. David prides himself in being able to find natural sources for many of the claims they encounter, but has the knowledge and ability to analyze and theorize about the phenomena that defies rational explanations. He lives in northwestern New Jersey with his wife and son. David, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, it's an honor.
Nice to have you with us tonight.
Well, after an intro like that, I don't know what I'm going to say.
Well, you could have leaned on a little thicker, you know.
My head's so big I can't get out of my chair here.
Oh, you know what? If you got it flaunted, Dave, that's what I always
say.
Well,
you know, I don't like to brag, you know. But anyway.
That's not bragging.
Oh, how you guys doing?
We're doing great, always, except for those times that we're not doing great.
And then you're not doing great.
You know, we were here in Florida when we were whining because the weather was unseasonably cold this year. And with May opening up, now we've gone from being a little bit chilly in April to, like, really nice and warm.
Yeah.
So it's toasty now. Very tropical.
I miss Florida. I retired from the University of Florida in Gainesville. So, and I actually grew up in Delray Beach since I moved there in 1963. So I miss Florida dramatically, but I came to New Jersey to make money. So.
Let's talk about your start in paranormal research back in '76. What got you into it?
Actually, it was the end result of a series of events that occurred in my life that I had no answer for. When I was very young, there were incidences that occurred in our family with loved ones who had passed beyond, coming back and giving us certain family members pertinent information and dreams that helped them to, like, say, for example, find something that they couldn't find that was lost, that was important, and things like that. And also, there were portents, you know, like my grandfather saw an animal that he believed was the harbinger of his death, and, you know, a few days later he died. And, you know, things like that that, you know, at first look could be coincidental and anecdotal, but there seemed to be a series of them that kept occurring. And, of course, my graduation night in high school, we all went to this haunted house down in Boynton Beach that was kind of like way out in the boondocks past 441. And a lot of weird stuff happened in the house that we couldn't explain. And then I went into the Air Force, so I couldn't do anything about it, but I had a lot of time to stew on it. And when I got out of the Air Force, I got a job doing something that paid money and decided that as a hobby I would, you know, try to investigate what was really going on in the paranormal field and try to find an answer to some of this stuff. And, of course, the rest is history, you know.
Yeah.
It's been the longest hobby I've ever held in my life.
Huh. So tonight the topic is physics of the paranormal, and we wanted to touch on a few of those areas. Anything come to mind, or do you want to focus on EMF, the relationship between EMF and EVPs?
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself, after all the research I've done, I really have three basic discoveries and possibly a fourth one on the way. And the first discovery, of course, is trying to understand the nature of what electronic voice phenomena, you know, is.
Mm-hmm.
And as an audio and acoustic engineer, you know, I've always been fascinated by what could be causing it, since it doesn't appear to be sound. And I've heard a lot of people say, oh, it's sound that you can't hear, which is ridiculous to even say something like that, because if it's sound, you hear it.
Mm-hmm.
The sound frequency spectrum is very specific, and if it's not in there, it's not sound. So I began toying around with the idea back in the early 90s about it possibly being caused by electromagnetic fields. And the first test, of course, was to do a bell jar experiment, where I actually took a bell jar, put a microphone inside of it, sealed it, put it into a vacuum until we didn't hear any more sound, and because sound doesn't travel in a vacuum.
Right.
And then run it in a very active location, and, of course, we got EVPs. So that experiment pretty much eliminated sound as being a factor in the equation. And then it was a matter of figuring out a way to prove that it was EVP, and it took quite a while to do that based on my budget and technology at the time. So
let me ask you this about the bell jar experiment. Could vibration have accounted for any of it?
Well, I mean, vibration is a very specific frequency. And you know, vibration, even if vibration had been a part of it, which, you know, you can't rule out vibration, vibration doesn't say words. Vibration is a very specific rhythmic vibration that occurs basically due to either seismic activity, wind blowing on a structure. I mean, there's a lot of different things that can cause vibration, but vibrations generally don't form words. And so the true test, of course, to me, I mean, you know, there's all these ratings for what an EVP is, you know, a class A, class B. I think that's all road apples, really, because either you understand what's being said or you don't, and if you don't understand it, it's noise.
Right.
And it's plain and simple. So,
well, it's at least meaningless.
Yeah, and the point of it is if you play an EVP to five different people separately, and all five of them say they hear the same thing, you got a pretty damn good EVP. And that's kind of my definition of that. But
provided
anyway,
it wasn't done by human.
Right, right. So, moving along, it occurred to me to start experimenting with using coils to attempt to capture EVPs, and I started out using actually microphone coils, because since microphones were the way we were picking them up in the first place, I figured there was something unique about a microphone coil that made it susceptible to, you know, receiving these EVPs. And of course, it's because it's designed to work in the audio spectrum, so the coil itself is going to respond to frequencies in that audio spectrum from electromagnetic fields. The microphone works in reverse in order to record an EVP, because instead of air pressure pushing on the diaphragm and then moving the coil in the magnet, mm-hmm. and then that creating the signal that's recorded, it's actually moving the coil within the magnet independent of the diaphragm, and it's the same effect. You're actually, you know, creating the sound file by the movement of the coil. But the coil is very fine wire, very supple, and it's very responsive. So microphone coils actually are the best detector for EMF.
Cool.
We've used regular coils with some success, but the fidelity is just not the same. And while you can capture EVP with coils, and we've done it, just so that we could prove that an audio file that was captured with a dynamic microphone matched a file that was captured with a coil, we did that in order to correlate, you know, the two of being the same. But you get the best results using, you know, a dynamic microphone. And actually, it doesn't matter what quality microphone you use. I mean, we've used some very cheap ones, and we've used some very expensive ones. But either way, the dynamic microphone's the way to go. A condenser mic doesn't work because it responds to changes in capacitance. So if you pick up anything with a condenser mic, you're actually picking up sound. And we actually use a condenser mic as a control mic in the environment so that we can separate the sound from the EVPs. And it saves a lot of time in editing because you can look at the waveforms and compare them, and you can see where there's an anomaly in the dynamic microphone versus the condenser microphone. So it's kind of a neat tool to save time when you're going over evidence. But that's kind of the route I took in the EVP, what it is, and that, of course, led to another series of experiments in trying to find out where the heck it's coming from.
So have you formulated any hypotheses about that?
Well, I have to base my hypotheses in science. We definitely do use the scientific method. We don't just talk about it. We understand totally what the methodology uh-huh. is. So you make an educated guess about something based on a series of events or some evidence you come across. So I began calling these EMF fields spontaneous EMF because it tended to appear out of nowhere with no apparent source. So we began to figure out there's got to be a way to trace it. So I'm going to build a triangulation device using three different coils and running them through, you know, low noise, high gain preamps into a distribution amp and putting, you know, oscilloscopes on each channel
mm-hmm.
so that I can compare the waveform strengths and amplitudes and try to narrow down where in the room the stuff was coming from. And it took quite a while to actually have a successful attempt at that. And the first success was last Labor Day weekend in Williamsburg, Virginia. And we actually, during an event, a heavy pewter salt shaker moved across the table.
Huh.
And we actually had all the right equipment in all the right places and managed to capture data to monitor the changes that were going on in the environment. And there were some pretty radical changes that occurred, which led to a more detailed hypotheses about what was going on, to where I postulated that there was possibly a portal or wormhole of some type that could be opening up that allowed this energy to enter into our reality. So taking the ball from there, I began to refine everything and started noticing the second time when we went back at Christmas time, we noticed that there were time anomalies occurring in this area. We actually built a time slip detector, it's called. And the circuit was originally designed to measure torsion fields. But what it does essentially is you take two very, very calibrated crystal oscillators, like 19 megahertz oscillators that have like a 0.0001% tolerance,
mm-hmm.
and you beat them against each other. And, of course, there's minute differences in the strata inside, so they're slightly off. And you end up usually with a frequency in the audio spectrum. In my case, it ended up being 700 hertz. So then we put, you know, a constant temperature source on both oscillators so that we could maintain a consistent temperature, so temperature drift wouldn't cause frequency shifts,
mm-hmm.
and maintained them both at like 40 degrees centigrade. And we got a time shift. We actually had a shift in frequency, and the frequency went up. And the only thing in the equation that's actually changing at that point, since it's battery operated, there's no variable, had to be time. So we actually had a time differential occur in the middle of this event. We had an extreme level of gamma radiation at the beginning and throughout the event. And, of course, you know, gamma radiation comes from, like, nuclear bombs and, mm-hmm. you know, gamma rays and things like that. From
what was the duration of the event, Dave?
About 2.5 minutes.
Wow.
It wasn't very long. I guess it seemed like it was forever. But it ran for about 2.5 minutes. It started very slight, build to a crescendo pretty much, and then faded back out again. And at the height of it, about a minute and 15 minutes, or minute and 15 seconds into it, it kind of peaked. And at that point, we had highly elevated levels of positive and negative ions.
Were you getting any visualizations of any, you know, any color changes, hue changes, or anything in that area? How big of a...
We did notice a slight ripple effect. Much like a mirage on the highway on a hot day, you see a little ripple
in
the distance on the road. The air kind of shimmered a little. It was kind of a rippling effect, much like a mirage. And it was in a very localized area. It was an area approximately around a foot in diameter that this occurred in. And it was just if you weren't looking at it, and if you were in the dark, you would have never seen it, which is why we really don't follow a lot of that foolishness of turning all the lights off when you're doing experimentation. We have some lighting available. The only time we'll reduce lighting in an environment is if the background EMF from the commercial power is too high that it's covering, you know, raising the noise threshold that could be interfering with actually picking up evidence. So in most cases, though, if you don't have a faulty electrical service, you don't have a very high level of 60-cycle EMF in the middle of a room. You'll find it near the walls where the outlets are and where the switches are and stuff. And you'll really find a lot of it down by the electrical panel. But generally speaking, in the room, it's at a much lower level. And so we, unless it's, you know, a problem where we've got a lot of EMF coming from the electrical service, we don't turn all the lights out. We'll leave a lamp on or a light on in each area that we're working in. Because we found that you see a lot of things sometimes associated with this activity that you miss in the dark. Unless you're using, like, night vision goggles or you're using, you know, some type of camera you're holding in your hand with, you know, an IR illuminator. But we're finding that a lot of this stuff is visible in the ultraviolet spectrum. So you tend to see more of it in the UV spectrum than in the lower end of the light spectrum in the IR section. So a lot of these cameras that are using IR illuminators, like night shot and night vision and stuff like that, you're not really catching what might be going on there. So we developed a very cheap and inexpensive, you know, way of doing our videoing by buying a black light party bulbs from, like, Home Depot. They're like $3.95 a piece. And then we would buy these, like, metal reflectors with the clamps on them that are like, they're like another $5 a piece. And you put four of them in a room, and it's like daylight in a camera. And you start to pick up things that you don't pick up under normal light or under IR light. So there are definitely things going on. I mean, we have noticed that there are instances of, you know, and everyone's going to go crazy, real orbs. And how we determine they're real orbs is another whole series, you know, of experiments where we actually did two camera shoots from two different angles by firing photos at the same time. And if you have an orb in one camera but not the other, it's dust. You know, it's something foreign in the air. But if both cameras pick up a round glowing ball in relatively the same spatial area of a room, it's kind of hard to write that off as dust. So then I built a collector in an attempt to capture one of these things. And it was basically a shop vac. I mean, this stuff you can't lie about this. I mean, it's just too ridiculous. I took a shop vac and some PVC pipe. And in the middle of the PVC pipe, I cut a section, put a coupling in, and on one side of the coupling was a mesh aluminum screen, like you put in a screen door.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, there was a mesh of aluminum screen. So when I pressed it together, there was like an eighth of an inch gap between the two screens. And I left a little bit sticking out of each screen so I could attach clip leads to it and actually, you know, put a volt ohm meter onto it and fired it up. And we actually went into an area and we captured one of these orbs, and it blew the damn meter up. And it, you know, fried the fuse in it. So we figured it had to be somewhere around at least 6,000 volts of potential to fry the fuse. And then it dawned on us that we were probably looking at a phenomena called cold plasma. And since we had elevated EMF readings associated with these plasma balls of energy, we are kind of assuming that it's kept stable by an encasement of an electromagnetic field. Just like a neon light works, neon light is cold plasma, an example of cold plasma. You have to keep it contained within a containment to keep it stable, because once you lose the containment, it dissipates or it discharges to ground. So we postulated that these were cold plasma phenomena that was created by the actual interface of the portal opening and the matter mixing between essentially two universes or from another multidimensional space. So consequently, we have a lot of things that we're measuring that actually aren't paranormal at all. They're byproducts of the conduit that opens up that allows the paranormal-like phenomena to occur. And I would say from what we've been looking at, 80% of the weird things that occur are the products of the portal opening. And probably 15 to 20% of it is the actual paranormal activity. But there's
What kind of environmental factors, Dave, lends itself to that phenomenon taking place?
Well, the first thing we note is there's a very dramatic drop in atmospheric pressure, almost like something's opening up and there's a differential between the air pressure in the two areas. The second thing that occurs is we start to pick up these bursts of gamma radiation, which is indicative of particle annihilation, which is probably due to exotic matter mixing with our own matter. And while it's not like antimatter, it is negative mass matter, so it causes minor annihilations at a subatomic level. So while it's not causing a nuclear explosion by annihilating atoms, it's causing these gamma bursts by annihilating leptons and quarks and that sort of thing.
Process of collision or however they're interacting. I guess the question I was asking was, you know, a lot of times people, the activities will take place in houses or residence or those sort of things. And I guess the question I was really asking was, what type of factors in the environment prior to the phenomena would be favorable for that occurring? That was what I was trying to get at.
Okay.
In a natural environment, what type of, because if these things are opening, as you say, and I have no reason to doubt it, but would there be any triggers in our natural environment that would cause it to happen?
Yeah, I don't think it gets triggered from this side. What we notice on this side is that the ability of the air to conduct electricity begins to dramatically increase.
Okay.
In other words, the air conductivity starts to improve, generally speaking, the humidity dips somewhat, which is cockamamie. In other words, the air conductivity should increase with the amount of moisture that is added to it, particularly if that moisture has mineralization in it, and particularly if it has ferrous mineralization in it, it will increase the conductivity. But we found that there's no explanation for the increase because the humidity is actually dipping slightly when this occurs, which is also indicative of something opening up and altering the atmosphere. And so we notice that first, and then as this thing begins to, you know, and bear in mind, you know, I'm not stating this as fact. I'm stating this as a hypothesis based on several experiments, so it's far from conclusive. But right now it's the only thing that makes any kind of scientific sense to me for a rational explanation of how this is happening.
Well, it certainly would be interesting, because most physicists, with my limited understanding of quantum physics and that kind of stuff, have postulated that the wormholes, if we could even open them on a quantum level, can be so tiny, so teeny tiny that
That's the thing. It only has to be as big as a photon.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? You can
right.
put a lot of information on a photon. And you know, we were actually, I was on our own podcast last night. We were talking about this whole wormhole thing. And you know, there's such a misconception that these things are like man-size or big enough to walk through. But they don't have to be, because all that's really coming through is pure energy in the form of EMF. And the other things that we are seeing happening are actually byproducts of the portal itself. So the gamma radiation is actually being caused by the wormhole opening and exotic matter keeping that wormhole stable during the course of the event. And then, of course, it collapses and disappears. These things are very transitory, and they don't always occur in the same place. They could occur in different areas of a home. I'd wager they're probably happening all over the world in all kinds of places. And there's really no rhyme or reason that we understand about it, but there may be rhyme or reason from where they're coming from as to, you know, why they appear and their duration. They may be coming from an area where time is different than time is here, and it may be a regularly occurring thing from their origin, but here it seems very sporadic and you know, irrational to us, because we have a different sense of time than wherever they're coming from. So, I mean, and you can get a headache thinking about this stuff, because the
yeah.
more you go into the possibilities and the probabilities, the more complex it gets. But the misconception is these things are big, and they don't have to be big. They can be very, very tiny. Like I said, all they need to be able to do is pass a photon through, and that's extraordinarily tiny. And when you look at it that way, these things could be happening all around us, and we would never know it. I think there are wormholes that are bigger. I think a lot of these things are associated with traditional holy areas or sacred sites. I think this is probably what's at work in Sedona. I think there may be a possibility that these vortexes or wormholes may be a condition that occurs in areas where there are a lot of disappearances. And I think in those cases we're probably dealing with a much larger manifestation of it. But again, you know, these are speculations based on a small amount of data from a small amount of experiments. So while it's very promising, and I'm of course following it as part of my hypothesis, I'm far from saying that this is the answer to what's going on. I'm just saying it holds a lot of promise to potentially be the answer for how the stuff is manifesting in our reality, in our perception.
It's certainly an interesting hypothesis. There's no question about it. Especially because, you know, like I was going to say, a lot of the physicists say, you know, even on the most small quantum level, that the wormholes don't stay stable. So just for that time, for 2 minutes, if one's staying open for 2 minutes, that's like an eternity.
Yeah, it is. At a quantum level, it is. But
yeah, and so...
Here's why the research is so very important, because not so much what it will do to the field of paranormal research, but this research could be huge in the field of quantum mechanics, because if we could actually prove the existence of a wormhole, that would be a huge thing in quantum mechanics. And additionally, there are aspects about quantum mechanics that make it at a very, very subatomic level. If we can find a macro manifestation of quantum mechanics, that too is huge.
Especially if they occur naturally on the basis that you're talking about. And I mean, you know, like, it's a big universe out there, and we're familiar with all the phenomena that could possibly happen. And I mean, look, we don't even understand the basic scaffolding of what our universe is resting on. And,
exactly,
you know, that's
right.
Dark matter, and we don't have a clue what that is. We don't
that's
know how
exactly
that interacts
right.
with us. We don't have the slightest idea. So the possibilities are absolutely endless. But what I find fascinating about your work is the fact that, you know, if some sort of interaction between particles is keeping that wormhole open, that's like right out of science fiction. Because, you know, even, you know, the science fiction writers talk about traversing a wormhole, and one of the major problems, first of all, is if you can open one of the damn things, and then number two is keeping it stable. And when you
that's
say
exactly
2 minutes,
right.
that's really wild. That's because that means, you know, if that's happening on a regular basis for that amount of time, then to me that makes me very optimistic, because that may be something somewhere down the line we might actually be able to do.
Well, see, the whole object of my work is to do it in a scientific manner so that the evidence has weight in the scientific community, because I am not a rocket scientist, but far from it.
Do you play one on TV?
Yeah, I play one on TV, but seriously,
Doug and I would like to.
Just ate a Holiday Inn Express.
Exactly. I mean, there are people that are miles ahead of me in the physics field, and if I can get them interested in pointing some of their resources at this, we have a much better chance of actually making a great discovery here. So that's kind of the motivation behind it.
Let me ask you a question, David, and I apologize if you in any way went over this. We had a little bit of an interruption in the chat room. You were talking about orbs and using two cameras, correct?
Yes.
And I believe, I think I may have, you have something published on your site, right?
Yes.
Will you give your website again for our audience?
Yeah, it's www.spin, investigations, just like SP investigations, one word, .org.
Okay. And you used two identical cameras, if I remember correctly.
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
Because I did not want to duplicate any artifact that the camera may create.
I got you. Okay, so I'm thinking of a different one. All right, so explain. So you used two different cameras. Did you get something you couldn't explain?
Yes.
Okay.
On several occasions, we actually captured an orb in both cameras in relatively the same place in a room.
And how does that prove that it's not airborne contaminants?
An airborne contaminant, in order to show as an orb, has to be within 4 inches of the lens of the camera. Otherwise, the camera doesn't pick it up at all. How it prints as an orb is the flash hits it, and because it's out of focus, it is a big blurry ball because it's out of focus. Now, in this out of focusness, I'm having trouble here.
Focusness.
What tends to happen then is that the orb itself is essentially visual noise, and it picks up detail. And then your brain looks at it and begins to recognize patterns, because that's what our brain naturally does. And from the time that we're born, we are born to recognize faces. And that's something that's deeply ingrained in us, and any psychologist or psychiatrist will back that up. But what tends to happen is this thing called pareidolia, which is a type of apophenia, which is making sense out of nonsense, essentially. That's
right.
The simplistic definition. But what we do is we assemble a perception of what we're looking at. And a lot of people are like, oh, it's got to be a ghost. I see this face in it. And it's nothing of the sort. What it is dust, I would say 95% of the time, or pollen or even moisture, that sort of thing. However, in an active environment where there is actually reported paranormal phenomena occurring, these things tend to be singular, not a whole picture filled with them. You'll catch one, and generally that one is occurring somewhere near the source of where this stuff is flowing into the environment. And my hypothesis is that these things are formed kind of like ball lightning, where the plasma is a reaction of the exotic matter interfacing with our normal matter, and it creates an interference. And that interference is much like if you've ever seen the power guys when they change a fuse on a light pole and they miss, you get this big arc and a ball of fire kind of floats along and hums for a few minutes. Well, that's hot plasma, which tends to have like a temperature of around 8,000 degrees. But cold plasma is very unique because it can have an ambient temperature of, like 85 degrees. And as long as it is contained, it remains stable. And we have postulated that the high levels of low-frequency EMF that are not complex, that are very consistent, almost like a pure sine wave, are probably the encasement field that is keeping that cold plasma, keeping its integrity in the environment. And even then, these things last for seconds. I mean, they don't last very long, and then they harmlessly discharge generally to ground.
And so you're saying that these could be something paranormal?
I'm saying they're a byproduct of what facilitates the paranormal.
Okay, I got you.
Instead of being the paranormal.
Are these visible to the naked eye rather than
sometimes,
just...
Sometimes they are, and what tends to happen is it's because they're plasma, they are being bombarded with photons when you take a flash picture. So for milliseconds, this thing absorbs hundreds of thousands of photons and can become visible. I've seen one visibly once before, and I photographed one with a 35-millimeter camera back in the 70s and discounted it as dust at the time. And now I know that there was no way I could have photographed dust with a 35-millimeter camera.
Well, it's not very common, I'll tell you that.
When you have...
Hello, hello. I think we may be back. I am trying to get everybody back on the air for some odd reason. We dropped out. And I'm trying to get Grant and David, our guest, back on.
I'm here.
Okay, Grant is back.
Hey, everybody.
If you want to let the chat room know.
Yeah, I will.
Refresh their screen.
I had a question. I was just asking a question when, you know, the Skype gods...
Well, I was... actually, David's not on yet, so...
Oh, okay, good, okay.
Just
good.
Let him know in the...
I'll let him know. They just David. Dropped us.
Yep. Here we go.
That was weird. I just disappeared for a minute.
Yeah, we were dropped. We were dropped. The Skype gods are hating.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, so... Let me let's just take a second so that our chat room people can refresh their screens, and let me tell them. And let me ask that question, or finish that question. I've got at least two photographs that were taken two different. Environmental. One was a dusty, you know, basement. Actually, it was more of a cellar type thing, and you know, underneath a building,
right.
Where there was lots of dirt, lots of dust, and you could see them in the picture. Lots of dust orbs. You know, no big deal. There is a electrical cord that was strung a length. You know, was strung from up at the roof. It was a crawl space. So it was like what, 5 feet tall, maybe. And so the cord was from at the ceiling, and it was going down to the ground, and it was stretched out over, I don't know, 20 feet or 30. And I took this picture, or one of us did, and there was a bunch of the dust orbs. One of them was partially obstructed by the cord about 10 feet out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's one example. Another example is a photograph that one of our board members, Dave Desjardins, took. It was outside his house. It was snowing at the time. It was... not nighttime, it was dusk, and you could see, you know, a lot of, you know, the moisture orbs. One of them was obscured by a swing set in the picture, which must have been in the neighborhood of 15 to 20 feet away from the camera.
Yeah.
How do you explain those types of things?
Well, I would say that in both of those instances, there's a very high probability that it may have been a cold plasma. The thing is prior to all of it, what actually stimulated us into doing a two-camera shoot was the fact that we had photographs much like what you're explaining, where we had, in one case, we had one coming out of a wall. We had another one that was partially obscured by a stepladder. And we, you know, really blew up these pictures to a pixel level to make sure we weren't just losing the orb in the background of the photograph, and it was definitely being obscured. And that's what clued us in to, hey, you know, maybe there's something to this orb thing. And I had always been involved in, you know, the problem in the paranormal field is you have purists. So you have the spiritual folks on the one side mm-hmm. of the spectrum, which everything is a ghost. You know, mm-hmm. oh, the orb is a ghost. They're friendly. They're following me around. They're mm-hmm. talking to me. They're saying my name. And then you have the debunkers on the other side of the spectrum, which are they're all dust. And I've always found in this field that there's no absolutes.
Middle of the road.
The truth always falls somewhere in between the two extremes.
Right.
So I figured, you know, the probability is that if there's something weird going on, and there is a possibility that a real orb may exist, and that set me on the whole path of how do you prove it and how do you find it and mm-hmm. what do you have to go through to do that. So, yeah, we got pretty similar results in a lot of investigations we did that had pictures similar to what you explained here, where we actually had an obscured orb. Mm-hmm. And we thought, this can't be dust.
Well, you know, Dave, don't you think that most people, the general public, and a lot of the folks that maybe are doing some research are really not aware of how dynamic, from an electrical standpoint, our atmosphere is? They don't have a clue.
They don't have a clue
about that. And a lot of things they might attribute to being paranormal, as you so eloquently stated tonight, are perfectly natural. That doesn't rule out the fact that they may be having secondary effects that we can't, can just postulate on. But, you know, I always think of how many people knew what a sprite was before we had sending shuttles up, okay? And so my way of thinking is if that sprite is all these multiple particle waves that are coming in from the sun, from space, they're being bombarded by all kinds of stuff. This soup in the upper atmosphere is causing these particles to intermingle and then form these maybe perhaps in the opposite direction, hot plasmas that are going grounding themselves out in the earth. Who knows
That's exactly right. Here's the problem in our field, and I hesitate to call it a field because that's taking some liberties, but for lack of a better word, 95 to 96% of the field are hobbyists.
Right.
They are people who see something on TV, go out and buy some equipment, and go out and hunt for ghosts. And there's nothing wrong with that. Don't get me wrong. I mean, God bless them. They've opened a lot of doors for us. They've gotten us in places we never would have been able to get into, and they've made this whole field a dinner table word now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dinner table discussion. So that's made my work a whole lot easier because, believe me, in 1976, you just didn't get invited into somebody's house to look for a ghost. So they've done a great deal to facilitate the serious researchers in this field. But the problem is there's damn few serious researchers in the field.
This is true.
And that is a problem because that's why the field has no juice when it comes to moving in scientific circles because mm-hmm. there's no empirically presented data to back up the claims.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've got can't be replicated. So, you know, I think that it's going to take folks like yourself and folks at Paranexus that think out of the box on a lot of this stuff, but also, you know, like to do the kind of work that you're doing, how you're looking at all these different – one of the things that I find very fascinating is how all these fields have to interact with each other.
Absolutely.
What are the ramifications of all this field interaction? How do we know? I mean, I'll go way out on a fringe, and Doug and I have kicked this around before. How do we know how those fields actually affect our human perception? How do we know that they don't either skew it or they do something interact with the way our brains function neurochemically?
Realistically, we know that it does.
Mm-hmm.
That, there's no mystery to that. We know
it
does.
Right.
But we also know what frequencies are required to do that. So if we have those frequencies present, then we have to start double-checking and double-blind-checking ourselves to make sure it's not our perception. And you have to look at it another way. There are no two people alike in their upbringing and their programming and in their environmental conditions. So the chances of two people witnessing the exact same thing that's a product of that are astronomical.
Uh-huh.
So if you have two people that witness the same event, even if there may be those frequencies present, you have to give it weight because uh-huh. the chances of two people seeing or experiencing the same thing because of that are pretty nil.
Yeah.
And if it happens on a regular basis, you can kind of lend a little weight to it. And you said something a little while ago that said, you know, that it isn't this is one of the words I have problems with, replicability of what we do.
Our replicability of experiments.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what I meant to say was, that's where traditional science or hard-nosed purists on the other side of the coin will completely say any data we get is good.
But see, they're looking at it wrong.
Absolutely.
If that attitude had been taken by Einstein, we'd have never had the atom bomb. So what actually you have to look at is, while you can't exactly duplicate conditions, there are commonalities. And you have to weigh the commonalities and study those commonalities, because that's where the secret is. You are going to have 100 different things happen, but if 20 of them are common in all the events, that's heavy weight. That's hard evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's not totally repeated verbatim, there are commonalities occurring that are consistent, and those are the things that you look for. The other thing is these guys that are out there hunting for ghosts, they're looking at the wrong things. They're looking at the effects, and they're measuring the effects. And how we're going to find the answers is by examining the interface. Just exactly what you were talking about, all these frequencies together coming in.
Mm-hmm.
We don't look at those frequencies per se, other than to identify them and categorize them. What we are looking at is the interface, where it actually creates the disturbance, where it actually creates the interference. And we study that interference, because that's where the real answers are going to be found.
Can be much more complex. Much more complex. I mean, this could be something that's not only affecting us on a physiological level, but, you know, it has all kinds of different ramifications.
The observer is a vital element in the process.
Yep.
And just like in quantum mechanics, is it a wave, is it a particle? We don't know until the observer takes the measurement. And then the field collapses and it becomes a wave or a particle. It's the same thing in this. The observer, this is why we monitor the team. We actually, everybody on the team is wired for sound. We carry portable recorders and lapel mics. We do that for a lot of reasons. It's a great tool because we do time checks along the way for reference so that we can correlate evidence later. Sometimes the personal recorders pick things up that other recorders don't. But either way, we're making a record of the actual team and their behavior, as well as when we have someone sitting at a apparatus table where we've got something set up to monitor aspects of the environment, they are being videotaped as well as the environment is being videotaped, so that we can monitor any strange or unusual interaction that may occur due to the observer effect. So I am so anal about objectivity. When we're doing that.
Yeah, well, that's important. It's really important.
Well, let me just sum up our orb discussion, because there's some chat going on about it, and I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. The problem that we have at Paranexus with the whole orb thing is that while we're open to the possibility, every bit that we've ever seen can be explained naturally by natural occurrences. Now, there is one area that's not so easy to explain, and that's when people see orbs with their naked eyes. And again, we have to be careful, because that does not necessarily imply paranormal activity. You've referred to it as cold plasma or similar, you know, so we don't know what that is. So, you know, we're still looking for answers. And you'd mentioned, you know, the true believers, everything's a spirit. And we just can't take that.
No.
We can't take that leap of faith, because
there's no evidence of that.
Yeah, there's. I mean, how do you know? People say, "Well, this is a true orb." You know, here's a shot outside with a zillion orbs in it, and one of them they say is true.
Right.
Oh, come
on. I actually have evidence that points to the fact that it is probably cold plasma, based on energy discharge and that sort of thing. The other side doesn't have that. It's I feel this or
right.
I sense this, and that's very. Anecdotal. I mean, there's not a lot without some kind of empirical evidence to back it up that gives it any weight. But that's not to dismiss the eyewitness account or the sensitivity of the human perception.
Mm-hmm.
It just by itself doesn't carry a lot of weight. However, if you take that and you have empirical evidence to back it up and reinforce it, then it builds a total case for the grand scheme of things. because each lends weight to the other. And you build it, – it's like I'm real famous for saying it takes a preponderance of evidence to make the decision or to make the call.
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right, that you have a paranormal event occurring. And the preponderance of evidence is not one photograph or one little piece of EVP or a photograph of an orb. It's a series of a lot of evidence that gets stacked up until the weight of that evidence becomes preponderance. And once the preponderance...
Oh, you mean we got to come back next week? Yeah, man. You know what I'm saying? Because that's what it boils down to. What, we got to come back next week and do some really research?
We've gone to places like 7 or 8 times. I mean, there's a place that we go to over in Pennsylvania like a couple times every month. We'll go over there and run some experiments because there's predictable activity there.
And that's what you need to do. I mean, that's how research is conducted. It's not conducted in a one-night stand.
Yes, that's exactly right. You have to go back, and then you refine your experiment.
You guys both know many breakthroughs have been made after years and years of boring research that nobody thought was going anywhere.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden,
exactly,
they had the proverbial Eureka moment. But it was only after working for years and years, getting nothing, no glamour, no nothing, before they came up with something that was really solid they could hang their heads on.
Let me tell you something, though. There's never been a vital discovery that's ever been rewarded with a Eureka.
Mm-hmm.
Here are the common words that are said during an important discovery. Gee, that's weird.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely correct, Dave. I made it so much later.
it's also
precisely
days or weeks
my
later. Yeah, it's weeks later before you figure out you've made a discovery, you know. It's like, what did I do wrong? Why is this here? You know, why am I getting this?
Exactly.
So,
it's probably
so,
back over the data that you thought you screwed up, and then you see, like, oh, my God, look at this.
Well, then you go back in the field and you repeat it, and then you either reinforce what you found or you dismiss it as an artifact. So, you know, there's a whole – I say famously, you know, I follow the scientific method. I don't just talk the talk. I walk the walk. That's part of the process. You don't make a conclusion from a single event. You go back and you do it over and over and over again to make sure you're not dealing with something, you know, that's an artifact. So it would be nice if there were other people repeating some of the stuff we're doing, because that lends it even more weight.
Well, that's the purpose of the show, you know. Our show is aimed at paranormal researchers, giving tips, techniques, tools, that sort of thing. Since we've only got about 6-7 minutes left, David.
Oh boy, time flies.
Yeah, I know it. I know. tell us some. Maybe you've got an interesting case that allowed you to draw some conclusions. I know you've kind of alluded to some, but what would you say is the most spectacular or interesting or meaningful case you've done or research you've done to date?
Something I did recently actually was eye-opening. I've often entertained the idea of trying to figure out how real psychics and real mediums get their information.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought, you know, that EMF tends to be the gold mine right now of what's going on because of the different levels and frequencies and that sort of thing. So I always thought that there was possibly a low-frequency carrier that this information rode in on,
mm-hmm.
and mediums, for some reason or another, were sensitive and could, like, decode that modulation, much
right.
like a TV set does. So in their mind, they're actually kind of watching a TV show to get their information.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're really doing is receiving these low-frequency transmissions. And I just recently went to a seance where a very famous medium, Jane Doherty, was giving a reading. And it was in a house that we had investigated previously for the client. So I was invited to record the event. And I actually did a little more than recorded. I brought some detection gear with me. And we noticed that every time she would call for someone to come forward, the spirit to come forward or whatever, this low-frequency waveform would appear. And it would last. It was very complex. It was like a carrier, so it was like a set frequency of somewhere around 4.5-5 hertz in that area, maybe 7 hertz. It's hard to tell at that level. But because it wasn't giving me a frequency readout, I was just having to judge it based on the sine wave itself.
Were you
riding,
you were using an oscilloscope?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
A handheld oscilloscope and a MagCheck 95 from Magnetic Sciences. It's a EMF sensor, and it frequency response 20 hertz to 3,000 hertz or whatever. But it works below that. It just doesn't have the same gain. It's not flat responding below that, but you can still pick up low frequencies with it. And I noticed this very low frequency thing would appear, and then when the circle would be broken, it would disappear. So over the course of the evening, and it was about 3.5-4 hours long, this thing went on, this
wow.
thing would keep reappearing when she would initiate contact, and then it would disappear at the end of it, and then it would reappear. It happened so much that I couldn't rule it out as being coincidental.
And there's nothing, no electronic equipment that could have accounted for that.
Not that low a frequency, and
yeah,
not where we were at. I mean, if it was 60 cycles, yeah, I could discount it. But,
yeah.
You know, we were in a living room, and there wasn't really anything other than 60-cycle EMF in the environment prior to the event. And that was another thing. When this happened, the 60-cycle background noise was blanked out. It was no longer present.
Hmm.
Just this low-frequency wave was present. So we interestingly said there may be a correlation in this to what they are receiving. So no conclusions drawn yet other than the next experiment when we go to a seance, and we're going to do it again, will be that we will actually bring triangulation equipment and attempt to source where it's actually coming from, whether the medium herself is generating it,
mm-hmm.
whether someone in the environment is generating it, or whether it's coming from some spot in the room that for no particular reason.
See, and that's a logical hypothesis, too. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
assuming for a moment that psychics are accessing the Akashic records or the cosmic library or whatever, you know.
There's got to be a medium for doing that.
Right. There's got to be some.
Unintended.
Yeah, and a carrier wave that's being modulated is a beautiful analogy, you know, that we understand with radios and television and
right.
all of that. So. Could that be? Could it be? Sure. Could it be some similar principle, but on a psychic wave?
Well,
you know,
we have to look at this realistically and scientifically. We can't go at it spiritually. We can't go at it based on these folkloric notions.
Right.
I mean, if we're going to make any kind of discovery, we've got to look at it scientifically,
mm-hmm.
and then our motivation has to be scientific in looking at it. So the first thing I do when I look at a situation is try to figure out what explanation exists in science that could possibly account for this. And then generally speaking, you usually come up with something that has a reasonable possibility of being, you know, an answer. And then you go and you test it. The problem comes when you can't find a source for the potential phenomena that you're watching. And that's what turns it into a quantum mechanical type of realm where you're dealing with stuff that blinks in and out, where you've got potential wormhole activity.
Which just makes it all the more fascinating, you know, because
mm-hmm.
it's just like the enigma just keeps getting better and better. You know,
the thing is, the more answers you find, you get about 200 more questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And because you've got to look at it more and more. It's like trying to find Higgs boson. You know, we've gone
mm-hmm.
down to quarks, we've gone down to leptons, and now we're looking for Higgs boson. I mean, where does it end? And it's the same thing with this. I mean, you got to keep digging and keep digging and keep digging. And
all right, with that, we're going to have to start wrapping it up. We're down to our last minute and a half or so.
All right.
We've been talking with David Roundtree. Interesting conversation. And your website, again, is spinvestigations.org?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So go take a look at David's website. If you haven't been to Paranexus.org, we'd love to have you. We are looking for members. Paranexus is a nonprofit research association, much like a trade association. We have a lot to offer, too much to go into in the final minute here, but we'd love to have you take a look. If you're interested in education, take a look at ParanexusAcademy.org. We have a lot of things to offer serious researchers, and that's who we cater to. So next week on our program, I'll go get that information real quick. It is Dr. David Lewis Anderson talking about experiments in time control. Should be an interesting conversation. And perhaps we will have David back on the program sometime to update us.
Yeah, David, by all means, we enjoyed having you here tonight. It's been a pleasure
Absolutely.
Speaking with you.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to come on anytime, guys. You guys are a pleasure.
Your research is important, you know, so If you come across anything, you know how to get in touch with us, and vice versa, and we'll have you back on the show because it's been really nice.
It's been really nice talking with you guys, too.
Yeah. And if you'll hang with us for a second, thanks to everybody. We're out of time. Have a great night.
Have a great night, folks. Bye-bye.
Good night.